show, everybody. It's Cairo Knights, Mason Mike. Happy Tuesday to you. It's Tutu Tuesday, Mike. Thank you for wearing a tutu. It feels good to not be the only one.
Well, I mean, also, I wish just the weather would warm up a little bit.
Yeah, it is chilly. It's chilly in a tutu. Yeah. They don't tell you that in school.
No.
No. Okay, should I just play the jingle?
Just play the jingle.
There's nothing in the world like Action Park.
There is nothing in the world like Action Park.
No, not anymore.
Not even Action Park.
Not once the lawyers assembled, there isn't.
So what is Action Park? A water slide, amusement park, go-kart track, downhill slide.
Obstacle course.
Tennis ball tank fight arena.
Crash test dummy collection center.
360-degree vertical looping slide of an amusement park. It was in New Jersey in, I think it was like 1976 to 1996 before it eventually got shut down. Multiple injuries. Several deaths happened.
Three drownings. Many, many rescues.
And just legend. I mean, here's a clip from a documentary about Action Park that sort of sets up the kind of vibe that existed there.
When you go to Disney World, you assume that if you're on Space Mountain and it breaks down, somebody's going to turn the lights on and climb a ladder and get you out of there. But Action Park, within seconds of entering, you knew there was no one who was going to do that. There was no one who cared.
It was sort of like, just do your own thing. And, you know, the staff would show up if someone got hurt, maybe. But there weren't a lot of restrictions that I remember.
You could just run around a park and know that nobody was going to care what you were doing. You know, like a 15-year-old from Long Island walking around with a Budweiser can was not frowned upon at all and very common.
So I could guess where you stand on this, Mike. That
yeah. I mean, so we are talking to, there's a bit of, a book has come out.
Yes,
Action Park, and we managed to corral the author to get on the phone with us.
Yes, joining us now is Andy Mulvihill. He is the son of Gene Mulvihill, founder of Action Park, and he is the author of the new book out today, Action Park, Fast Times, Wild Rides, and the Untold Story of America's Most Dangerous Amusement Park. Andy, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, man, it is so great to be on your show. Can't wait to talk to you about the book.
As a kid who loved amusement parks and particularly liked the more dangerous, at least my impression was, the faster the ride, the more dangerous it felt, the happier I was as a kid. But I got to say, growing up in California, I never, maybe they just had more advanced tort law there, I never ran into anything like the videos I've seen of Action Park. Let's just start with what is potentially the most infamous ride, which you yourself did a test ride on, apparently in hockey gear. Your dad came up with the idea of a complete loop water slide. Essentially, it's a rocket sled down into a loop at the end that then spits you out into something. I'm not sure what. Tell me a little bit about your experience riding this ride, and did your dad not like you?
Yeah, you know, there were six kids. I wondered if he wanted to only have five when he sent me on that one. But, you know, it wasn't just a 360-degree loop. It was an inverted loop, vertical loop, so that you went up all the way up vertically, and it was, oh, my God. He asked me to test it out, and thank God I had brought my hockey equipment that day. And I put it all on, and I'm in this tube that is like a long, steep slide, but it's in a tube, and it's pitch black, and I can see from the outside looking at it that it's going to go, you know, upside down, and it took a lot of courage. I mean, I tested a lot of rides. That one was the scariest, and man, when I went in that thing, I didn't know whether I was going to come out alive, but it was really more of a ride to survive than enjoy.
So there's been a story, a legend, urban legend about that ride, that when you guys sent a dummy down at first, not you, but an actual physical dummy to test the ride, that it exited the ride headless. Is that true?
Well, you know, there are so many stories like that about Action Park. I don't know. Maybe that one's true, but I never could understand why anybody would ever make up a story about Action Park when the real stories were just so outrageous on their own.
Good point.
Right. That's what I'm learning here, is that every insane story you hear is true, that you really couldn't make this up. I want to know, take us back to the founding of this thing, because it is simply madness. Tell me about your dad. What kind of a person has both this idea and the ability to execute? Tell me about your dad.
You know, my dad was a unique guy. He was a real American pioneer. He was pretty fearless. He was a risk taker, tremendous entrepreneur. But he wasn't the type of guy to settle for doing something that had been done before. He wanted to create something that people had never seen before, to give him a thrill that was unbelievable. I mean, our slogan was, there's nothing in the world like Action Park. And that was really true. I mean, think about it. In one day, you could drive a race car, a speedboat, or a tank. You could learn to fly. You could go on a bungee jump, bobsled down a track, do a water slide with a jump, or even do the 360-degree loop. I mean, Action Park wasn't an amusement park. It was a participation park. You know, most parks, they just strap you in and give you a little thrill. Action Park, you controlled it. You could master of your own destiny. Go as fast as you wanted. And it was so exciting. People just kept on coming back for more.
Is it true that you were talking about tanks, the battle action tanks? Is it true that people shot tennis balls soaked in gasoline at each other?
You know, it wouldn't surprise me if some wise guy that worked there one day fiddled with something like that. I didn't see that myself. But the thing that was incredible about that ride is, you know, you're in these tanks that shoot tennis balls, and at the other tanks they have targets. And if you'd hit the tank, it'd spin around. But it was all in a big cage, and there were guns on the outside so people could shoot the tanks from the outside. But the thing that was really crazy about it is there was a ball collection system that didn't always work. So sometimes the workers would have to go in and collect the balls. And as soon as they did, these New Yorkers, they wouldn't go for the tanks. They would try to shoot the employees. It was crazy.
It's like at the driving range where they come out to try and clean up the balls. And you hit them.
So Action Park, run us through the brief history. Action Park existed in New Jersey from when to when?
So it started in like 1976. It had a 20-year run until 1996. You know, my dad lent some money to some guys that had the Vernon Valley ski area. They couldn't pay him, so they gave him the keys. And so he had this ski area that's sitting empty for, you know, 6-7 months a year, and he wanted to monetize it. So he got the idea of putting up some rides. And, you know, he was a real pioneer. There had really never been many water parks, if at all. And he kind of made it up as he went along. And he would find guys with crazy ideas. And if he thought it would be thrilling, he'd give it a shot. Sometimes they worked, sometimes they didn't. But boy, did we find some crazy rides, and the people loved it, man.
We're here with Andy Mulvihill. He is the son of Gene Mulvihill, founder of Action Park. And Andy is also the author of the new book, Action Park, Fast Times, Wild Rides, and the Untold Story of America's Most Dangerous Amusement Park. To no one's surprise, there were a tremendous amount of injuries that happened. There were some deaths at Action Park. But when people talk about it, they mentioned that. But if they went, they talk about how much fun they had, the experience, the just unique thing that it was. What was day to day like? Who went there? Who was running the show? How did that all work?
Well, you know, my dad had a brood of six, and he put us all to work there in the summers. You know, he made us work hard, but he also let us have fun. Imagine being a kid, you know, working at your dad's amusement park. But, you know, Action Park attracted the craziest of folks. Like, he'd have a kid that would go to Action Park, maybe with his girlfriend, and he'd see these rides, and he'd be like, oh, my God, I'm coming back next week. And he'd show up next week with 10 of his craziest friends, not the book readers, the crazy guys. And they, you know, New Yorkers, they don't want to be told what to do. They just want to go and do it. So it was a struggle every day to kind of keep some order. And, you know, people had fun. And it was, you know, the other thing my dad loved is my dad loved competition. So a lot of the rides were set up so they were competitive, where you could race somebody. And so people pushed the limits to beat their buddies. And then you had things like a lot of the rides you could view while you were waiting in line. We had a ride, we had this one thing, it was just a cliff jump, but it was a high cliff jump into this huge lagoon that he built. And everybody in the place could see you as you're going to go. And inevitably, there'd be somebody get up there, a little girl or some guy, and they chicken out, and the crowd was unmerciful. They would just scream, "Yo, you chicken, you chicken!" And it really was a fun place.
So let's talk real quickly about two of the most infamous rides in the park. Let's start with the Alpine Slide, which apparently was designed essentially to just remove your skin.
Well, you know, the Alpine Slide, my father found that one in Germany, and I'm sure that when he got a hold of the designers, he said, "Look, I don't want any just, you know, calm ride. I want a steep ride." It was a bobsled ride where you had a cart and you pushed the handle down, wheels would pop out, you go fast, you pull it back, wheels would go up, and pads would slow you down. So you could go as fast as you wanted, but they were right next to each other so you could compete and race each other down. And sometimes people went a little bit too far. And, yeah, you could crash. And if you slid out and your arm or leg or knee touched the slide, it would just, like, pull the skin right off you. So sometimes it was like a leper colony at Action Park with the burns that people would walk around with.
Well, and wasn't that the ride also that featured photos of kids who had been injured at the top to warn you to pay attention you're on the ride?
My dad's philosophy was, you know, let people take risks, let them know what the risks are and the consequences of pushing the envelope. So, my God, we'd give speeches, "Don't do this, you could get hurt," or "Look at this burn you could get." We'd, like, give people warnings, but they'd still go for it and having fun. You know, it wasn't about getting hurt. It was about the thrill. It was like skiing. You know, my dad loved skiing. And if you go skiing, you want to take it easy and go down the bunny hill and be safe, you can. But if you want a thrill, you go up to the top, you go down the steeps, you ski in the trees, you hit the bumps, and that's thrilling. But with that comes risks. You could get hurt. You know, he was just trying to – he was making it up as he went along. It had never really – none of this stuff had been done before. And, you know, with it came certain issues.
Okay. The second ride we need to talk about here is – and I think this perfectly encapsulates Action Park for me. You guys had a wave pool. And when you hear wave pool, you don't necessarily think danger. It's a pretty more relaxed ride, if you will. But at Action Park, it was nicknamed by some the grave pool because there were serious issues there. How
three drownings?
How in the world, Andy, did you guys manage to inject that much danger into a wave pool?
Well, you know, I'm sure that my father, when he bought it, and it was one of the first installations. I don't know that the guys that designed it really knew exactly what they had come up with, but I'm sure he told them, "Look, I want big waves," you know? And so it was a big pool with big waves, and it was not easy to swim through the thing. It was a challenge. We killed ourselves to do the very best we could to protect people, but when people don't know how to swim and they jump in a pool that they don't belong in, it can create problems for folks.
Let's talk about designing rides, because I read that your dad was always on the lookout for the next big thing at Action Park. And he would, if somebody had an idea, he would latch onto that idea, and that person could design a ride, and maybe they had never designed a ride before in their life. Is that true?
100%. You know, he would go all over the world to looking for ideas. He'd go to the amusement park show. He'd find a guy in a little booth that no one was paying attention to that had scribbled some ideas. And if he thought it was a great idea and possible to do, he would hire the guy. He'd bring the guy up. You got to realize now there's like all these companies that manufacture water slides and rides. There were none of those companies back then. He had to find guys that had these unique ideas. I mean, the one craziest one was the man in the ball and the ball. That was just insane.
What is that?
So there was a guy that had the idea of putting a person inside a ball that was inside another ball where there were ball bearings. And you'd fit in a chair inside this ball, and the guy built a track down the mountain, back and forth and back and forth, so it wouldn't get going too fast. Well, anyway, the guy built it. It seems to be working well. We're going to open it like the next day. We have the state inspector comes up to check it out. And we have a tech guy gets in it. And he heads off down the hill. The problem was, it was the first hot day of the summer, and the guy had used PVC pipe to build the track. it expanded. And as the ball's going down, the track falls apart and the ball busts loose and goes flying down the mountain straight, picking up speed. The inspector like dove out of the way. The thing went through the parking lot, across the highway, and down into a swamp. Thank God the guy didn't get hurt. Oh my God. That one we didn't get right. That never opened.
I was gonna say, and then you opened it next week.
Yeah. Oh man.
What inspired you to do the unabridged history of Action Park?
You know, most people that went to Action Park have a story. Me and my family and friends, we have hundreds of stories, and we just kept on telling them. And I said to myself, I got to do a book. And then Knoxville came out with this movie. I heard he was coming out with a movie inspired by Action Park. I said, Andy, enough. Tell the story. Tell the story so people really understand it.
You're talking about Johnny Knoxville from Jackass, Knoxville.
Johnny Knoxville, you know, not Knoxville. I said, I got to talk to this guy. You know, it wasn't as if I couldn't get him on the phone. I couldn't get him off the phone. When he heard about the place and I was talking to him, he kept on asking me, you could really do whatever you wanted there? Whatever you wanted? He loved it. He loved my father. He was so great about my father. He says, oh, your father was a genius. He was ahead of his time. You know, he was the kind of guy that his ideas inspired guys like Knoxville.
Yeah.
And, you know, this whole X Games thing. You know, he didn't know what he was exactly doing. He was creating a new place. And sure, there are still thrill seekers today. There's crazy stuff you can do today. You just don't do it in an amusement park anymore.
Right. Yeah, so the rules have changed, I think it's safe to say. You know, Action Park has a ton of nicknames. Traction Park. Class Action Park is one of them because you guys were involved in multiple lawsuits with people being hurt. Now, of course, it goes without saying you couldn't have an Action Park the way it was back then today. But can you talk a little bit about the lawsuits and did that have anything to do with the eventual closing of Action Park?
Well, it certainly didn't help, and it certainly was a factor. But, you know, my dad was ahead of his time. He was self-insured because the premiums that he had to pay were astronomical. So he kind of took the whole thing of the litigation that occurred and brought it in-house. And what we would do when someone would get hurt is we would interview them right then and interview the people around them. And it was amazing how, like, 90% of the time, the person would start off by saying, oh, yeah, I wasn't following the rules, or I wanted to, like, jump on top of my buddy. And so, you know, we managed to really take care of, get rid of a lot of things quickly. If we were wrong and we didn't operate things right, we would try to settle and pay people. But if we thought we were right, we would litigate all the way through, and we would usually win. We got to be pretty good at it, but no, they did pile up, and it became, you know, it became a bit of a problem.
That is Andy Mulvihill. He is the son of the founder of Action Park, the world's most dangerous amusement park, and he is the author of a new book. It's out today, Action Park, Fast Times, Wild Rides, and the Untold Story of America's Most Dangerous Amusement Park. Andy, thanks so much for taking the time today to talk to us. We really appreciate it, and good luck with the book and everything else. And we will be back, folks, more Cairo Nights right after this. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the show, everybody. It's Cairo Nights, and this is Wonderwall. Question of the day is coming up at 8:45, and I'm going to say it now. We're soliciting. Okay, we want to hear from you. 989-973-98973. That is the State Roofing text line. Shoot us a question of the day, and maybe we will pick yours to answer in just a few moments. But first, let's talk about aeroplanes, because there's two big airplane, at least commercial airplane manufacturers in the world. One is right here in our backyard, Boeing, and the other is a European company, Airbus. And there are big stories about both of them. Let's start with Boeing. Yesterday, Boeing began the three-day process of test flights, of recertification test flights that basically the FAA is going to use these test flights to evaluate their changes to specifically that MCAS system that was responsible for those two fatal crashes that happened what seems like forever ago at this point.
Yeah, so what's happening right now is that Boeing yesterday took off from Boeing Field in a 737 MAX, flew to Moses Lake and back, hour and a half total flight time, not a whole lot of flying time, but they on board was Boeing test pilots as well as FAA inspectors as well as a couple of other, you know, other advisors and whatnot. And this is a series of flights. They gather all the data. They test the MCAS system. And then they begin the process of actually changing, like, what the FAA is going to require Boeing to change in the flight manual and what the FAA is going to require Boeing to do to train the pilots on this thing. The whole thing that Boeing had skipped prior. One, the software wasn't entirely correct, but mainly, I mean, much of that could have been solved had they told people it was there,
right,
and had they trained people appropriately how to get rid of it. And I do understand that there are some basics that every pilot should know, but nonetheless, you would want to know if you're a commercial pilot that you have software that you may end up fighting with at some point.
And this emergency.
In an emergency, and this is what happened with the 737 MAX. And so all of this means that now begins the process, the formal process of recertification, which is huge for Boeing in that, I mean, it's not a great time to sell airplanes, but it's a good time to get this thing done because Airbus also isn't selling airplanes right now. So it's not like Boeing faced a problem that all of its sales were going to be canceled immediately. Airbus was going to get all the, well, it turned out that because of the pandemic, I'm not sure that worked out well for anyone. It certainly didn't for commercial aviation, but to the extent that it leveled Boeing with its big competitor Airbus, that's probably true, at least from a commercial sales standpoint. And Airbus just announced that it is laying off even more people than Boeing did, and Boeing just laid off 13,000.
Yeah, 15,000 jobs. That's 17% of Airbus's commercial jet workforce, according to the Seattle Times. They're going to be laid off in the next year. The CEO of Airbus said, and I'm quoting here, in-depth analysis of customer demand. After they looked at that, it does not expect air traffic to recover to pre-pandemic levels before 2023 and potentially as late as 2025. That is very serious news for the airline industry.
And that's not that's an improvement from where it is now, but that's just getting back to where they were.
Right.
That's not getting ahead of where they were.
Right.
This is going to be from every industry out there, very few industries are left untouched. The industries that have done well in this, delivery, Amazon, things like that, they are being changed very rapidly on what they are going to have to do. The industries that were stopped nearly entirely and that are facing bankruptcy, from restaurants to Boeing and Airbus, they also are going to have to change not only what they're doing, but they're going to have to change what they're offering because this could remap the way people fly around. Boeing was just in the process of really trying to get involved with a jet being built by Mitsubishi, which was going to be a smaller Embraer sort of size jet, maybe one of those 30-seater, 40-seater ones for even shorter hops. They're very, very efficient airplanes, but canceled that as a result of all of this. It is not going to be – it may move ahead on that with somebody else. It is not going to move ahead on it with Mitsubishi. And this is part of it. All of these things are part of this complete change of a giant industry that it doesn't know right now what the demand is going to be. One of the things that's actually encouraging, if you talk to people in at Boeing, is that there is they do actually expect if there is going to be a return to demand of airplane sales, where it's likely to happen is on planes the size of the 737 MAX. And so if you noticed, Boeing did start up slow production in some places on that. And that is going to, they seem to think that if they can get people back on this aircraft, which is an open question,
yep,
and get the airlines trusting them, which is an open question, but who else are they going to go to other than Airbus?
Right.
I think that there is a decent opportunity for Boeing to be able to get to start selling some of these again, maybe even before January, if they can get recertified, if they can get recertified in September, and that's what the goal is right now.
I can't remember what the situation is at Boeing, but according, again, to the Seattle Times article, they talk about how over at Airbus, currently, this is before the cuts that are going to be made, the 15,000 jobs. A lot of Airbus employees are already working part-time to try and make up for the financial losses, and then their governments are sort of reimbursing them or paying, you know, out those unemployment benefits to try and keep people who had full-time jobs or now working part-time jobs still being able to make money while trying their best to try and mitigate losses on either side as best they can.
Yeah. So the difference, one of the big differences between Boeing and Airbus is that Airbus is a multi-nation consortium. And so Airbus has always been, and Boeing has always argued and stressed that Boeing, that Airbus is much more heavily subsidized than it is. Boeing doesn't like to talk about, the form of Boeing subsidies tended to be in tax breaks. Mm-hmm. So to suggest that Boeing isn't subsidized is wrong. To suggest that it's subsidized in the same manner as Airbus is probably fair. And in this particular regard, a lot of those that at Airbus, there was already this integration with the governments that are putting money into it to get the, to make these people either pay partial salaries or whole salaries. Boeing is separated from that. Boeing depends on the same unemployment insurance system that everyone else does. Mm. Boeing also resisted any effort to have the government become an investor in Boeing and pushed that away to go to private equity. So as this plays out, I think that people at Boeing, like people at Airbus, should expect one additional layoffs. Two, this is going to, when if this returns to something like it is, it's going to return much, much smaller, and it's going to return much, much slower. And it's going to be really interesting to see, like, all of these jets that Boeing had, two or three that it was actually on in the drawing books right now for next generation, you know, intra-national flying, mm-hmm. and international flying, whether or not these things get mothballed semi-permanently.
Why is it that, and this is not a jab at Boeing, because I think I understand it from Boeing's side. Why is it that some companies or industries just take forever to adjust? You know, I would say it's because of their size, generally speaking. But then you have a company like Amazon that is enormous that can pivot fairly quickly. Now, I understand Boeing builds airplanes, and that is an incredibly lengthy process. There's a lot involved in building an airplane. But why do you think that it just takes some industries and some companies forever to pivot, to modify, to adapt?
Well, Boeing's an old company, and so there's a lot. It has been doing things in Boeing way for a long time. It has managed to get, it has modernized to the extent that it was putting out more than one 737 MAX a month. I mean, that is a sign of enormous advancement in assembly line and in mm-hmm. rapid assembly of aircraft. But like you said, it is aircraft. What is your incentive to sell quickly when you are one of two people who sell what you sell?
Yeah.
Essentially, I don't know. I can't say that. I know that they worry about losing sales to Airbus. Airbus worries about losing sales to them. But if Boeing were not adapting quickly, Boeing would not have made the 737 MAX. And if Boeing were not racing to get out in front of a new aircraft offered by Airbus, it might not have cut corners on the way to making that aircraft. Yeah. So there is your liability and why some companies can't turn it around more quickly. They, even when they turn it around quickly, there is so many variables in building a modern aircraft.
Yeah.
That
it's mind-boggling.
Personally, if they turn it around slowly and make a super safe airplane, uh-huh. I'm all for it.
Slow and steady wins that race. Yeah, I agree. Question of the day. Get your text in. 98973. It's coming up next. We want to use one of yours. Kyra Knight, stay tuned. Of Boeing people texting in, telling me why stuff takes so long, and I they all sound right. Things are made in advance.
Yeah, yeah.
If you file changes, you got
you have
a few planes on the
paperwork.
Line. Yeah,
even when you start the design process, you may not even still be employed by the company by the time that plane comes from design
It's like, so you know, the way you talk about medieval architects.
Right.
Who frequently didn't outlive or didn't live long enough to see their creations
right.
built.
That's, yeah.
I'm not sure Boeing's in the same category, but it sometimes feels like it's not
sky
far
cathedrals.
Off.
They're sky cathedrals.
Wow.
Frank Shires is in here with us.
Present.
Do a little question of the day. We're going to let Anders talk.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd like to say we're going to let Anders talk. It's mean, but you get
not allowed all the time.
Like we could stop him.
I know. He's got a button. Actually, he could
he's
he could,
more
he could
stop than us.
Yeah, yes. He could stop us.
All three of us.
There's a power imbalance here, and it makes me nervous. Makes me uncomfortable. You're liking it too much. Tonight's question is, what is something, and of course we want to hear from you, 98973. What is something that you've held on to for a long time? Maybe you've moved a bunch, and this thing has always come with you, or what's an object that means something to you that, or at the very least, that you've just had for forever and can't seem to get rid of? Mike?
I'll go last on this one.
Oh, okay. All
right. My answer's a little different.
Oh, I like that.
Okay.
Frank?
Okay, two quick ones. I have a typewriter, a hand manual typewriter that my parents gave to me when I graduated from high school. I can't remember the type, and it's packed away. And I also have the alto saxophone that I played badly for my almost all of my school career. In a case, my daughter played it for a while.
Yeah,
yeah, badly. No, she was okay. I was bad.
It's in the genes.
Yeah,
it's in the genes.
Yes, it is.
You know, I used to make saxophone mouthpieces.
Really?
Yeah, it's one of my million jobs.
Metal or
I had.
Plastic?
Both.
Cool.
Both.
That's
yeah,
very cool.
You can't really like we didn't shape the metal ones. Kind of came
as
pretty
are,
ready
yeah,
to go.
Yeah, yeah.
We just had to gussy them up a little bit. But the plastic ones, you have to file down and get the calipers out and get the sizing just right. And there's angles and glass.
I was
and gonna
sandpaper. Say, you have anything to do with the reeds that came in or
no? It's just it's the thing that
just
it's the mouthpiece that you strap the reed onto. Yep. That's gotcha. That's what I made. Reeds are a whole different ballgame.
Yes,
Anders, how about you, buddy?
Very similarly to Frank, I do have a trumpet that I played in jazz band that I, you know, hold on to every here and there. I play every once in a while. But the one I'm going to do today is going to be one of my first pair of soccer cleats when I changed from a youth kind of regular just rec soccer player to where I kind of took it seriously and started really practicing every day and, you know, indulging myself in the soccer culture. So I kind of carry those cleats around with me to kind of remind me that, you know, at any time I can just set my mind to something and it'll be one of the coolest things that I do.
Wow. That's a good answer.
Cool.
You want to hear mine?
Sure. Yeah, let's hear yours.
I have a t-shirt from a Fish concert. 1995.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well.
It's my oldest article of clothing.
Vintage.
It fits because luckily... it was the style of the 90s to buy things oversized.
Yeah.
And so I, very scrawny 15-year-old me, 14, bought a very large Fish t-shirt, and it still fits me, although it is full of holes.
That you've finally grown into.
Yeah, yeah. I've grown into it.
Oh, nice.
I've grown into it.
Yes.
253 says, the guitar pick I used in my first concert 37 years ago.
Wow.
That's awesome. Oh, I also have a Bible my grandmom gave me, like when I was born, for Christmas. I was born in November, and for my first Christmas, she gave me this little black King James Bible, and my name is embossed in gold on the front, and there's this little note from her on the inside. That stays with me, too.
That's pretty cool. So mine's just the opposite. The last time I moved, when my girlfriend and I bought the house we're living in now, I had moved five boxes, sort of roughly, you know, legal box size, like the size of a case of beer, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Five boxes like that, filled with stuff, all kinds of stuff that I had moved with. I moved to college with these boxes, out of college with these boxes, back to Modesto, to Sacramento, and then from Sacramento is when I was coming here. So I'd been moving them around. The point that I moved up here for 12 years, something like that. I've moved them a bunch of times, maybe 13 years. And I moved them up to Seattle. And then one day I was in the basement and said, you know, I haven't opened these things in 14 years.
Uh-huh.
And I threw them away.
What?
Without opening them.
No
you
way!
You threw them away? You didn't take them to, like,
whoa.
Goodwill or something?
Threw them
away.
Well, you don't know what's in there, Frank.
I have no idea what's in there.
They're going to be compromising information.
I knew that if I opened them.
That's amazing.
I would not be able to get rid of it.
Wouldn't let him go. Yeah.
I still have no idea what was in there, and I can't think of a thing I'm missing. I know it wasn't photos because I label photo boxes.
Uh-huh.
I thought, like, I'm a big saver of, like, old paperwork and things like that.
Yeah.
I don't have any idea.
That is a baller move, Mike Lewis.
It was hard. I still think about that. It actually felt pretty great.
Ooh.
Over time, it feels a little worse.
425 vinyl record collection. From 12 years old to now, and they're 53.
Oh, that's a perfect.
206. I have my original very first issue, Pro Skateboard, from Danny Way. Very first Pro
Danny
Skateboard.
Danny Way's. Yeah. That's pretty great.
Yeah. That's awesome. Wow. Very cool. 9 o'clock hour coming up next. You know how we do. Stacey Joe, after the break. Stay tuned.